Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today is an award-winning children's author, columnist, and speaker. T.E. Watson helped start a local branch of the California Writers Club and served as founding president of this collective of North State writers. He received the Jack London Award for his service. T.E. Watson is best known for his children's books, but for his latest book, he drew on 43 years in the publishing industry. Later in the hour, he will share his tips on writing and the realities of publishing from his new book, Light and Stone. But first, let's listen to a previous interview when he talks about one of his children's books. Both T.E. Watson and his illustrator, Steve Fashad, live somewhere in the North State. Welcome, T.E.
Thank you for having me. Yes, very well done.
You might explain why I wasn't specific about the town you live in.
Only because we, both of us, my illustrator, who is a very different, I'm sure he appreciates his privacy too, but it's one of those things where people actually come to your door and say, please read this. And I've had a lot of it, so it's...
Because other people want to write children's books. I would think a lot of people do. They grow up, when their children are growing up, they're reading to their children, think, oh, I'd like to write a children's book.
Yeah, we get a lot of that, actually, yeah.
And so, to keep you from knocking on your door, I'll just say that you're a local writer.
We are resident of the county, yes.
Well, I'm curious about your using your initials, because a lot of times a woman writer will use initials to obscure the fact that she, so her gender isn't an issue. I was wondering if you use your initials, because there are a lot of famous Thomas Watsons, for example, mm-hmm. the founder of IBM, and mm-hmm. there's a senator, U.S. senator named Thomas E. Watson, mm-hmm. and of course the famous golfer Tom Watson. Mm-hmm. And so is that why it makes you a little distinctive?
A lot distinctive, yeah. I'm the only one in the industry, except for a gentleman back in Connecticut, I believe, who's got a T.E. Watson as well. And he writes religious stuff. And so to differentiate between the two of us, I mean, he's 86. I'm not. The T.E. Watson was something that I got stuck with when I was a child. And my sister, when she would get mad at me, she would call me T.E. So it stuck.
But it came in handy you became a writer.
Very much, yeah.
That's the distinctive. Well, I'm talking to T.E. Watson, who is a writer of children's books. And I mentioned that he has a lot of children's books. And I wanted to go back to an early book that you wrote called Iwana Iguana. And I'm not just slurring those words. That's the way it's written on the cover of the book. Iwana Iguana. I love saying that. How did that get started?
Iwana Iguana was just as all authors do, they play with words. And my wife and I came out of a local library at the time, and we were playing words. And she said, I wanna. And I said, you wanna what? And we just went from there, and I wanna iguana. And then the gears kicked in, and it took me about 3.5 days to write and 7 years to get published. So, but it was
So the title came first.
The title, book. Yeah. The title usually, for me, it usually comes first.
Well, you know what I had fun with? In the very first page of this story, Iwana Iguana, there's a little boy sitting in his room, and on his walls are lots of posters. And I was wondering if you and Steve got together on that, your illustrator, Steve Fashad, because one of the posters says Iguana Park, like Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
And another one says Cancun, Mexico, home of the iguana.
Yeah.
But the Iguana Park is like Jurassic Park, and I was wondering if that's kind of the fascination of an iguana, is it is like a modern-day dinosaur.
It's like a dinosaur. Well, unfortunately, Steve didn't do this one, but John Raptus, yes, that's his real name, Raptus, who did this iguana book, let me back up a little bit. When a book came out, it was the time of Jurassic Park and all this.
That's what I was wondering when I saw that poster.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when all that stuff came out, he decided to go and find everything in his little brother's room to see what was in there. It was totally related to everything, and he counted everything. There's supposed to be like 26 pieces of whatever it is iguana-wise in this room on the first page. It says, I want an iguana.
These items in this boy's room, in the drawing, in the illustration, actually were based on what was in a little boy's room.
Yes.
Oh, I love that.
It was, and it's quite fun because the first page, it sort of draws you sort of like a Where's Waldo book.
Yeah.
To say, where is he and how many other things are in here?
Yeah.
So it's quite fun.
Okay, so that was one of your first books, I Want an Iguana.
Yeah.
And then the iguana, and you didn't want to write any more iguana books?
I did not want to write another lizard book, no. It did well. I mean, it became the picture book of the year for 2001.
Once you finally got it published.
Once you got it finally published, yeah, right. And it did very well after that and continues to do well. But no, I did not want to do another lizard book.
Well, but your next book, you kind of kept a similar creature.
2 years after the fact, yeah.
Yeah, so a couple of years later, you wrote a delightful book. Mom, can I have a dragon?
Yeah. Everybody needs a dragon.
Well, this was a delightful story. And in fact, it was so delightful that you have made a recording of yourself reading this book, Mom, Can I Have a Dragon? And you brought one of those recordings with you. And I'd really like for listeners to be able to hear this. This is T.E. Watson reading a story that he wrote, and it's called Mom, Can I Have a Dragon?
Mom, Can I Have a Dragon? By T.E. Watson. And read by T.E. Watson. Sam was excited. The back porch screen door slammed behind him as he clomped up the hallway from the kitchen to the base of the stairs and called out, Mom, are you home? No answer. Sam called again. Mom! Mom came to the top of the stairs with rubber gloves and a scrub brush, and wiping her forehead with her sleeve, she asked, Samuel, what is it? Mom, can I have a dragon? Mother corrected him. May I have a dragon? May I have a dragon? Sam asked. No, you may not have a dragon, she answered, as if she really believed Sam, but gave him an odd look just the same. Now, dinner will be in a half an hour, so get washed up. Disappointed, Sam said, All right. He hung his head and scuffed his feet as he walked to the back porch door. Sam went outside and looked up. Mom said I can't keep you, but you wait. You'll grow on her. She's not so bad for a mom.
This is T.E. Watson reading from his book, Mom, Can I Have a Dragon? And T.E., I noticed something that you can tell you're a former teacher because this mother doesn't miss a chance to correct his grammar.
Exactly.
She's not too concerned about the fact that he's asking about a dragon, but he should use proper grammar.
Yes, it's exactly. And my mother did that to me, and my teachers did that to me, and so on. Yeah.
Plus, she comes to answer his question, and she's right in the middle of cleaning. She's got a scrub brush in one hand. She's got on rubber gloves. And it's like, I have to get this cleaning done. Let me get back to my cleaning side. Mm-hmm. And I'll bet that's really quite true to life.
I'm not quite sure how it is nowadays because, of course, my mother's not hanging over me with rubber gloves and all that. But I would think to a point, yeah.
That parents are so wrapped up in their responsibilities and what they have to do that they really don't always follow what's going on with the kids.
Yeah, exactly. We wanted to do that sort of in the tradition of Roald Dahl because Roald Dahl is one of my favorite books, and he had almost insisted on making the adults in his story look like absolute twits. And I love that about his books because it's like we're not always that responsible and we don't always pay that much attention and we should, you know. So it's like if a child of mine was to come and ask me, can I have a dragon, I would pay attention. But I would know that because he'd be my kid, you know. So
Well, and Sam, the hero in this dragon book, seems to have his feet on the ground. He's well grounded in reality. It's the parents who seem to be distracted.
Yes.
And so he goes back and tells his dragon, sorry, Mom doesn't think you are out to keep you. But he does find a place for his dragon to stay in the cellar.
Yeah.
So here are these parents with a dragon in their cellar,
And
they're totally oblivious.
Exactly.
Even when they see the dragon, they think, oh, gosh, I had a rough night last night. I must have been dreaming.
Yeah.
Thought I saw a dragon in the cellar.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And it's so funny because this being Mom, Can I Have a Dragon? Started out as a spur of the moment type thing after the publisher said, please write another one. And I said, no, please, I don't want to do another one. And then, you know, like I was saying, 2 years after the fact, this had come out And just boom, I was saying, I was just writing madly to get the first draft down. I was in the middle of a meeting at the time, and I said, pardon me, I have to do this.
Got to write down these notes about a dragon.
And it turned out, I was going back into my memory, thinking all the things that I used to do when I was a child and what happened to me at the time. And this turned out to be more of an autobiography than anything.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's Mom, Can I Have a Dragon? Is I can say sort of and safely my autobiography.
Well, obviously it wasn't a dragon that you wanted to bring home.
No, it was a beagle puppy.
Oh.
And I did not get to keep the beagle puppy because we found its owner. But dragon sounded funnier. So.
Well, also a dragon in not in Western culture. In Western culture, dragons are fearsome, fire-breathing beasts to be slain. Mm-hmm. But other cultures, Chinese culture, a dragon is not as a very favorable light.
Oh, yeah.
Dragons are viewed. And your dragon, I mean, the sketch, not your illustration, but in your book, the dragon is a very lovable character. I loved him. He has this great expression on his face. His tongue is usually hanging out
he's
the
very,
side of his mouth.
Very, very dog-like, yeah.
yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
He is. He could have been a beagle.
He could have. He very well could have been, yeah.
But much more fun that he was a dragon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not all cultures have fire-breathing dragons. Some cultures have just meat-eating dragons, and some cultures have dragons that actually take care of them. So,
you know what? Speaking of what it eats, this dragon loves salad.
Yes.
And I thought, now there's a nice touch. Just get in a plug for fruits and vegetables or vegetables.
It was so much fun when we came up with the idea of a salad. And we said, oh, wow, what can we do here to help promote good eating in the book? And we thought, let's try it and see what happens.
Let's have the dragon really like salad.
We have a lot of kids now that eat salad that wouldn't before. So it's quite nice.
Well, and it's also very colorful, too. And you've got that salad there. You've got all these greens and reds. So that salad looks very appealing. So I'm hoping maybe some kids will latch onto that notion and think, yum. That's what I'd like for supper, Mom. I'd like a salad.
Yes, watermelons and cherry tomatoes and fruits and peppers and all kinds of stuff in there. Yeah,
that was what the dragon wanted.
Absolutely great stuff, yeah.
Well, now that you said great stuff, that brings me to the other books you wrote. Because I liked all the books, but I think your specialty, maybe, if I can say that, are these Celtic stories.
They are a pet project, yeah.
And one of them, I mentioned, one is a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And usually when we think of fairy tales, we think of Grimm's, which stories, which are not really fairies. But your fairy tale is about fairies.
Yes.
And but I wanted to ask you about the folk tale.
Yeah.
Because you say it's a folk tale, and yet you say it's an original story. Now, which is it?
It's both. It's actually going to be both. In Scotland, it's really well known right now. So it's turned into a folk tale. The original story was told to me by my grandmother.
Yeah.
And when my gran had come back for a week after actually taking care of a friend, and a dying friend at that. And so she told me this. I was essentially raised by my grandmother. And she had come back to me and
In this country.
And she had come to me and explained to me through this story what she had been doing.
Now, was your grandmother born in Scotland? Because I know your ancestors were from Scotland.
Yes.
Right? And your grandmother was born in Scotland.
Yeah, my grandmother is Isabel Fraser. She's a best-selling author in Scotland.
Ah, so you came by this heritage, both bloodline and artistically creativity.
Yeah, it's quite nice, actually. She came to me one day when I was about six, thereabouts, and said, come here, boy, I have a gift for you. And I held out my hand. She goes, no, it's not that kind of gift. Put it down. She said, I'm giving this to you only. And she said, I'm giving you this gift of writing. Uh-huh. And I didn't know what she was talking about. So
You're too young, lad.
Yeah. So she said, you know, from here on out, whatever you do, you turn to this and you'll be fine. And so that's ever since then, it's been great. I mean, I won numerous awards from the time I was 10 until now. So,
Well, you include, speaking of gran, you include a glossary in your books because you use some Scottish terms. And you also warn your reader, these are not misspellings. I've written these words this way because that's the way they should be written.
Yeah, it's kind of hard because of the fact that, you know, here in America, they spell something completely different than what we do in Scotland. And then the difference is there's either one or two extra letters sometimes. And I get called on the carpet a lot as for numerous what is called a misspelling. And I go, no, it's not. Look in your dictionary. and I can prove it.
Well, for example, in your story about the man who spoke with cats, you explain what bangers and mash is.
Yeah.
And I knew what they were, but I hadn't realized, oh, that makes sense. I hadn't realized why these sausages were called bangers.
Yeah.
And you explain in your glossary.
Yeah, the bangers were a World War I thing, that because of the contents of the actual sausage, because that's essentially what they are, when they got hot, they'd explode.
Because they had a lot of water in them.
Yeah. And so, you know, they'd sound like a gunfire. And so you get a whole platoon of
these. You'd get a bang
out
of them.
Yeah, you'd get a bang. And that's why they would be called bangers.
So you get in a little local color in this story to start with, your fairy tale called The Man Who Spoke with Cats.
Yeah.
Your folk tale.
Folk tale. Yeah.
And you get in some of this local color with the bangers and mash and the roundabout, which we think of as a traffic circle. Mm-hmm. I do in England. It's also merry-go-round.
Roundabout.
Yeah.
It's not a merry-go-round. It's a different thing.
Well, it is. In the story, you say it can be a merry-go-round.
Yeah.
Merry-go-round. But I would like you to read this story because I especially found it heartwarming. And we might mention that Mr. McGregor, and I, of course, want you to say these names, but and he has four cats.
Yes.
And one of them has wandered off, and the other... Because he and his cats have conversations with each other, so they're all concerned about this cat. Yeah. Why don't you read us from The Man Who Spoke with Cats? This is T.E. Watson.
This is about two or three pages into it. A new day's sun awoke the family. Cleo, Tavish, and Little Face were asleep on the blanket across his legs, helping keep McGregor warm. And when he served breakfast that morning, it wasn't as enjoyable as usual. They were all still sad about Blue Eyes. She was not there to eat her favorite meal of salmon. McGregor missed the little cat and blamed himself for her leaving. And if he could only know that she was doing well at her new home, it would ease his worry. An early morning, excuse me, that's my book and I should know it. An early evening sunset found Tavish waiting on the edge of the porch. And Little Face found the highest peak on the roof to span the best view of the village. Cleo sat herself on the porch rail, gazing toward the stone fence. And suddenly, something made Cleo want to get closer for a better view. A faint, lighthearted meow was heard coming down the fence path in the distance, and all the cats perked up with their ears with excitement. The meow was all too familiar. Cleo called out, "She's coming. Blue Eyes is coming home." The Siamese was skittering playfully about the top of the stone fence, and she stopped to smell the jasmine and heather growing alongside. A moth flew out from the flowers, and she tried to catch it. And Tavish leaped up on the railing to sit next to Cleo to see for himself. Little Face was close behind. Blue Eyes was greeted with smiles and welcoming purrs. "It's good to see you. Where have you been?" Little Face asked. "I'll explain everything after dinner. Where's McGregor? He must be sick with worry." "He's been sad ever since you left." "Your being home will brighten his mood," Tavish said.
So the kitty returns.
Kitty returns, yes.
And Tavish is one of the names of these cats.
Yes.
And what does it turn out? Why had this cat disappeared?
The cat had disappeared because she had gone off, as my grandmother had told me, she had gone off to help a sick and dying friend.
Well, now, when your mother told you this, did she tell you, "I'm going to tell you a folk tale"? Did she say, "I'm going to tell a story"? Or did she say, "I'm going to tell you something that I know actually happened"?
She told me in a way that I could relate to, having always been an animal person. Mm-hmm. She told it to me in the reflective of cats. Cat families always had cats, so she told me in that fashion, and she made herself as Blue Eyes, and she made it understood to me that I was McGregor. So
she assigned characters, and this cat in the story goes off to comfort a dying neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mrs. Fraser. And it was funny because I put the name Fraser in there because it was her last name, her maiden last name. Mm-hmm. And so it was one of those great things that I thought, oh, this is marvelous. So I contemporized it a little bit, because most of the places in the book and the illustrations that Steve Fershot had done, I gave him photographs of the villages.
I wondered about that.
And he did an outstanding job of it, just so he would do that. But, I mean, he had did I mean, it's probably one of his best works. But the for what my granddad told me is that a little bit different than what the book is, but it's the same story.
Because I know that once I had my college roommate was visiting, and she and I sat up talking about the fact that her father had recently died.
Yeah.
And when we got ready to go to bed, I had a little dachshund, and she would normally sleep with me right next to me. And
yeah.
that evening she went and crawled in bed and snuggled next to my friend, who she had never met before.
Yeah.
But she could tell, and I don't know how animals do this, but that's why I think your story is not really a fantasy, other than the fact that the cats speak English. I mean, I think cats and their owners communicate, particularly Siamese. That's what is a Siamese cat. But I think animals, in this case my little dog, had that sense of, this person needs comforting, and I'm going to comfort her.
Yeah, it was quite nice. I mean, what the publisher done is in the inside jacket. It says, placed in the wondrous countryside of southern Scotland, the man who spoke with cats brings a feeling of love and being needed that each of us as humans are given by our beloved pets. They give to us without expectation and take care of us in every way within their capabilities. And I think that's true with all animals. I mean, it's not just cats. I mean, whatever animal you have, they are there to help take care of you, and they're on a whole nother level. So,
well, and another thing I liked about your story is a lot of times stories, movies, for example, the animals have to be put in peril, and I don't want to see that.
Yeah.
Your book, I mean, they wondered where the cat was. They were concerned about the cat, but the cat was all right and was off doing good.
Yeah.
And I even know a story, a woman here in Chico who had a young daughter. She lost her daughter when she was 21, and she said her daughter had cancer. And she said the cat would go over and put her paw right where the cancer was and lie there with her daughter, comforting her.
Yeah.
And this is why when I read your story about the cat going to comfort this woman who passed away peacefully in her sleep with this cat having comforted her, I thought of this friend of mine whose cat did that with her daughter.
Oh, marvelous. I love that. That's
great. Yeah, so that's why that story for me is true. It might be that the cats are speaking English, but otherwise it rings really true to me.
It's quite fun. I mean, I can't really call it fun, but it's a very nice reaction to see when people come back to me and they say, this is a marvelous book, it made me cry. I said, well, I'm sorry it made you cry, but I'm glad you liked the book. You know, so and I'm glad it's touched so many people. So Gran's up there smiling at me somewhere. So.
Oh, I'm sure she is. Let me tell people again, the name of this book is called The Man Who Spoke with Cats. It takes place in Scotland. It's a Scottish folk tale by T.E. Watson, and the illustrations are by Steve Fershot. And this book... then it takes place in Scotland. And then I mentioned you also have a book, A Fairy Tale, which is about fairies.
Yes.
And when I was reading this book, I thought of my young niece. When she was small, she would tell me about these small people.
Yeah.
And she would talk about them with such emotion.
Verb, yeah.
Exactly. It wasn't like she was making up the story and saying, well, what will I say next? She was recounting what these, sometimes they were mischievous. And when they wanted to get on her good side, they would wear her favorite color. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I wonder what she will make of this when she gets older. So I saved notes that she made when she was young, and I gave them to her when she became an adult.
Yeah.
And a lot of children, I found she had friends who had stories about small creatures.
Oh, yes.
And yet when they got older, they tended to forget or think, well, they made it up. They seem to lose touch with that part of themselves.
Oh, that's a shame, because the fairy people are all over the place, and they're still around. You know, the Americas, they've got lots of them. I know a small boy around the corner from me who was very into fairies, and he's got fairies all over the place. You can see them.
Well, since we were talking about fairies, that's who the characters are in. You have some children, too.
Yes.
But the characters in your book, Glen Robbie, and the cover has a West Highland Terrier.
Yeah.
And I love those little dogs. I don't happen to have one, but my brother has three.
Go away.
In fact, one of his was on TV, you know, America's Funniest Home Videos.
Yeah.
This little dog tapped a bell to go outside, and I saw on the internet somebody wrote back and said that felt that little dog should have won first place instead of second. But but so I have a soft spot in my heart for Westies.
Yeah.
So can you read a little bit of this is Glenn Robbie?
Yeah.
T.E. Watson.
Days and weeks passed. A few of the ambassadors returned unsuccessfully, and others came home with the same sudden face of regret. More and more days went by, and soon everyone was home, all but Kara and Podwink. Could they have been eaten by the fox, or perhaps gotten lost? Everyone in Glen Robbie was wondering what became of them, and the villagers began to worry. And what was worse, a Highland rainstorm was looming. The storm blew in and rained endlessly over Glen Robbie, and the villagers did not care about the rain. Their dear friends, Kira and Podwink, were gone, and they missed them very much. In time, the storms began to clear, and still no sign of the two ambassadors. Yet, far off on the lee side of Ben Nevis, somewhere down in the Great Glen, a wee fairy lass was shivering and cold. It was Kira. She had traveled farther than anyone from Glen Robbie had before and lost her way. And when the storm darkened the skies above Scotland, Kara found a small sheltered opening on the base of an ancient abbey ruin, and her delicate wings were drooping with wet, and her tiny nose was dripping with sniffles. And the storms passed, and nighttime came, and so did the night noises. And the loneliness of being hungry and tired made her very afraid. There are many things in the night that can take a fairy away from their loved ones, especially a fairy that is all by herself. Kara heard an owl hooting in a tree above, so she stayed very still. And the sound of grass rustling and a wee moosey walking nearby made her even more frightened. But in time the noises calmed and Kara drifted off to a peaceful rest.
I might mention to listeners that when you say moosey, you put that in your glossary, that's a mouse.
Yes, it's Doric, is this way my grandmother spoke. My grandma, matter of fact, I had an uncle that spoke nothing but Gaelic because he was his protest to the English language. But yeah, moosey is a mouse and all that.
Well, we've mentioned some of the children's books you've written because that's what you do now. But what other projects do you have going on now?
Wow. We have the audio books. We're doing 5 audio books. I've got 2 commissions that I've been constantly seemingly working on. One is the... I don't exactly know what they're calling it now, but basically it's to help writers learn how to really write. Mm-hmm. And the other one is actually doing...
So you're going back to your role as a teacher.
Yeah.
And you're helping mentor new writers.
Yeah.
And coach them along.
Yeah, and despite the fact I don't want anybody to come to my doorstep, I'm still doing that. So anybody to help, I mean, this would be teachers, this would be students who want to learn how to write properly and things like that. Because having been, started out as a reporter, mm-hmm. So I did reporting. I've done magazine writing. I've done every bit of stuff that you can possibly do in writing. You can do. It's one of those things where, But the one thing that I really enjoy is still showing children how to get excited and motivated about writing. And that book was a commission. And it's called Presenting Successful School Visits, something like that.
So you encourage reading and writing for all ages.
All ages, you bet. Yeah.
After a break, I will ask T.E. Watson for tips on writing and publishing, which he shares in a new book, Light and Stone. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Paradise author T.E. Watson is a 43-year veteran of the publishing industry. He is an award-winning children's author, columnist, and writing book coach and speaker. His latest book, Light and Stone, is a pep talk for would-be writers. T.E. Watson, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me back again.
You've written so many children's books. Do you even know how many you've written?
I have literally lost track. I know I've got four new ones coming out.
You always have a new book coming out. And many of them are beautiful color illustrations by Steve Rashad.
Most of them are, yeah. Steve's done an outstanding job for the books. And now he's taken on for these new ones. I've got two new color output type books that he's doing. And he's been doing black and white. The line art for some of them.
Yeah, because I noticed one of your new books is for a little bit, a lot of your books are for young children. And your new book, The Going West, you aim at third and fourth graders who are studying pioneer history of America.
That's correct.
And Steve did black and white illustrations for that book.
Yes.
Since it's a little bit older, prep student.
Yeah, it's the book has gone nuts for me. It's on this particular debut, we combined all three of the Going West series into the one book called The Pioneer Journey. And that is so, we found that some of the readers didn't mind reading the smaller books because it came in a book series of three. So they just combined them and said, let's do this. And the process worked really well. People tend to like the bigger version instead of having to buy all three. It's actually cheaper this way. So we just ran with it, and it's doing very well.
And it's a little bit of a departure from you, too, because you usually let your imagination run wild when you write children's books. But this one is a true story.
It's correct. Yeah, this is a story that actually started. Wow. I was asked to do this by the then publisher of the Paradise Post. And then it started out just as a kind of a fluke that one of the grandmothers up in Paradise, who I knew, asked me to help her with a heritage project for her fifth grade granddaughter. And one thing led to another, and it went crazy. And I said, I honestly don't know anything about your family. And she said, that's not a problem. And she handed me this 3-foot tall stack of papers that all had their family genealogy on it with documentation and diary entries and all the stuff. And I'm going, this is incredible. And the more I got into it. So here you go. Here's Going West.
Yeah, so this is a combination of three books. So it's copyright. The content then you worked on from about 2003, wasn't it?
Yeah, it took me 10 years to write. Yeah.
10 years working on this book. Now, you were saying that you were requested, somebody said, would you help out here? Tom?
Yeah, basically it was the request from essentially a parent to help their granddaughter with her heritage project's assignment that her teacher gave her.
Now, I might mention, I just called you Tom because since this is North State and about local writers, your friends know you as Tom. Publish your books under T.E. Watson.
That's correct.
I might just mention that in case people said, what? Did she say Tom?
Yeah.
And I imagine, too, that Tom Watson conjures up a golfer and they think, oh, is Tom Watson writing books now?
Well, we went with the T.E. Watson because actually that's the other real name because my sister's name is A.J., so it sort of stuck. If she ever wanted something, she would call me T.E. Or if I got into trouble, my parents would call me something else. But that, other than that, I'm always done by T.E. as my writer name. So, yeah.
So you were asked to help out with this book, Going West. And that's true of also your book, Light and Stone, that somebody said, hey, Tom, or T.E., I'm not sure how he would have called you, what about writing a book on writing and publishing?
That's correct, yeah. I was at a seminar for the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators as a speaker and ran into an agent who I became really good friends with. And he asked me to say, I told him I was going to write this. And he said, when you get it done, let me know. And so here it is another, 10 years later because everything works that way. And went from there.
In fact, that's one of the points you make in your book, that if you're going to be a writer, you got to be prepared to be patient because publishing takes a long, long time.
Well, for me, it's just because of the fact that there's so much information in here, it's 38 chapters, that it takes forever to make sure that it's right. And even though I knew it was right, I wanted to make sure that the writing was right. And I didn't want to set this out and make myself look like an idiot. But so
because you're going to be writing this for would-be writers.
That's correct.
You better
yeah.
be a good role model, Tom.
That's right. That's right. I'm working on the second one now called Fire and Air. And that's more realities of publishing and writing tips and tricks and all that kind of stuff. So it's gone well. It's gone very well. The book Light and Stone has got six or seven five-star reviews. Well, on Amazon.
Since you just now mentioned the title, Light and Stone, how did you come up with that title?
Oh, that was easy. That was easy. Light and Stone was something I was thinking about for a long, long, long time. And I thought, okay, there is the light part of writing and there is the stone, solid, core, hard part of it. So I thought, okay, where am I going to do this? So I found this picture that I took in Scotland in 2003 or 2004 of the inside of the Wallace Monument, which is about 604 feet, goes straight up.
And now, do you still have family? Or I'm sure your ancestry, I'm imagining, goes back to Scotland.
Ancestry is in Scotland and family's in Scotland and just outside of, it's actually inside Elgin.
So all the more appropriate that the photograph on the cover of your book was taken in Scotland. And you took this picture yourself.
I took it, yeah.
But, you know, Tom, it is rather foreboding looking to me.
It's supposed to be.
Oh.
Because when new writers get into this thing and they go, I don't have a clue as to what I'm doing, which is 99% of the time. I wanted them to look at this and go, my God, what have I gotten myself into? And if you look at this, it's dark, it's dank, it's damp.
Well, I don't think we've told listeners what it's a picture of.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, it is the stairway inside the Wallace Monument, which goes straight up and has room for about two people, more or less.
It's narrow, in other words.
It's very narrow. It's more likely a person and a half, depending upon the size of the person. But
and steep. It's narrow and steep.
Steep, almost straight up.
And dark.
Yes.
But at the top of the photograph,
there's the light at the end of the tunnel. So yeah.
Light at the top of the stairs.
Yeah. So there you go. If you climb this journey of this hard stone stairway, and some people will go, I can't do this. This is too difficult. And then they look up, they go, wait a minute, there it is. So it's symbolic in that sense. You know, they see that light, which we sort of cheated on that. But
I thought it was enhanced because that light is very bright.
It is. But for the most part, there is a light. You can go all the way to the top of that tower, the Wallace Monument, and be a great place to fly kites because the wind is intense. But the journey for any rider, if once they see this, they'll get it. Plus, you know, there's a chapter in there, or prologue. I forgot what I put in there. But the idea is to explain why this cover is the way it is.
Yeah, so, you spent a good bit of time, Ink, on the cover, more than most people would. I mean, a lot of writers don't mention the cover at all.
Yeah.
But you do explain that cover.
Yeah. I felt it needed it. I'm not sure it actually needed it, but if I was in Scotland, people would understand it. There's a very large contingency of writers and creative types in Scotland. So I'm not sure with something like this writing essays. Most people are familiar with Writer's Digest series and things like that, where they would see a very decorative, very text-filled title-ish, or title-esque, rather, cover. This is more graphic, and because writers are very intensely visual, this was perfect.
And it also leads the viewer's eye into the picture. It leads you in. Let me remind people that I'm talking to T.E. Watson, and his latest book is Light and Stone, Essays on Writing and the Realities of Publishing. Now, this book, the title has two words in the title, and your book is divided into two parts.
Yeah.
How did you determine, so part one is light, part two is stone. Mm-hmm. How did you determine which chapters fit under which category?
That took a long time because everything was a little, I don't want to say intense, but it had to be correct so the people who would read this would understand that this is the easy part. The second part is the hard part. So the stone part. So that's where we got that determination. The idea between making what's light being easy, whatever it might have been, took a long time because some of that stuff could have very easily fit in the stone mm-hmm. side of the book.
Well, I like, too, the fact that you could pick the book up in any chapter and read it. It stands on its own.
Yes, I hope so.
And so people can read a chapter or go back and reread a chapter.
Yeah.
Something I think people, even non-would-be writers, would find intriguing, Tom, and that is when you were saying, well, you hear the old advice, don't quit your day job.
Right.
And so you mentioned some of the people that had day jobs, well-known writers mm-hmm. who did not quit their day job.
That's correct. Yeah. I had the pleasure of especially, I knew a couple of them. I was at the Michigan Readers Conference in 2003. It was lunchtime and everybody was scrambling to get their lunch and sit at the nearest whatever table so they wouldn't miss out on the next seminar. And one of the fun parts was, as I happened to find, I guess it was the last and only filthiest table in the place. And so I said, I give up. I'm sitting down. Well, here comes a guy who's in blue jeans, a T-shirt, kind of a scruffy hair, short hair, almost balding man with wire-rimmed glasses. Kind of a scruffy, short.
Unimpressive,
short,
are you saying?
Yeah, it was very unimpressive. And I didn't have a clue as to who he was until he sat down and he reached over to me, shook my hand, and said, "Hi, I'm Elmore Leonard." I went, "What?" So we got into this conversation. It was more him talking and me taking notes, but it was an incredible, incredible hour and a half that I spent with him. Now, during that time, now this is the other fun part. As I sat down at this thing, all of a sudden he looks up and he says, "Hey, Kurt, come here."
Oh, my goodness. Let me guess who the Kurt was.
Go ahead.
It must have been Kurt Vonnegut.
It was, yeah. And that was incredible. And they just started talking shop. And here I am trying to bounce like a ping pong ball, finding all this information. I took down all the notes I possibly could. And I just learned so much in that time. I mean, everybody he wasn't eating anything, but Elmore Leonard was eating his sandwich, and I was eating my sandwich, and I'm going, okay. Just right as scrambled-brained as I possibly could and just got it all down. Now, it was really cool because of the fact that, unfortunately, I did not get to know Kurt Vonnegut as well as I got to know Elmore Leonard. But the idea was that after a while, Elmore got to where we were doing emails. So I would ask him, I would bounce ideas off of him. And I can't say some of the stuff that he said, but for the most part, it was so valuable and just an incredible journey there.
Well, I'll remind people that Kurt Vonnegut wrote Slaughterhouse-Five, Breakfast of Champions. And I was intrigued by the fact that he was the first to open a Subaru car dealership in 1957.
Yeah, he said it was the best thing he had ever done because he didn't sell a single car, but it gave him plenty of time to write.
I thought it was amusing, too, because the Subaru is a very popular car now.
It is now, yes.
He would be very busy now. He wouldn't have time to write.
That's correct, yeah.
And then you mentioned, of course, Jack London being an oyster pilot, a pirate.
Pirate, yeah.
Pirate. And Charles Dickens worked in a shoe polish factory from the age of 12.
Yeah.
Now, Agatha Christie. When you know what her background was, you realize, oh, that's why she's always poisoning her characters in her stories.
Yeah.
What was her background?
Well, as far as I can remember, it's been a while since I looked at the book, but I believe she had something to do with working in a morgue or a funeral parlor.
Well, an apothecary assistant, you say.
Okay,
and then
okay.
So that gave her the pharmacology experience that she needed when she was writing her stories.
Yeah, now the apothecary situation was much different than what it is today. So she had a little more access to it and the poisons, which I have learned a lot about because I'm in the middle of writing three murder mysteries. I'm changing genres, guys. To the point of these were raw, almost herbological type poisons, you know, what is it, belladonna and all those other types. And I studied the startings, the beginnings of the pharmacology businesses in the UK. And it was like, oh, wow, this is cool.
And this brings up a point, too, that you make in your book, to do your research.
Oh, very much. Very much so.
And I think a lot of times beginning writers don't realize how involved that can be.
Yep. Yeah. If you don't do your research on anything, I mean, some of the best advice I ever got was from another very famous author when I was a tiny kid. And he just basically told me, write what you know and you always succeed. If you don't know it, you can't write about it. It just makes sense.
Well, another author who wrote what he knew, and that was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And a lot of people probably know that he was a surgeon. He was in private practice. And so when he would have a conversation, but his main character was not a doctor. He didn't have his main character be a doctor, but Dr. Watson.
His sidekick was a doctor.
His sidekick was a doctor. So they could have conversations that would be realistic. So you're making the point that it's not realistic to think you can make a living at being a writer, that all these people that we assume were so successful that they didn't have to have a day job.
This was in their early days, though, because of the fact that when you were first starting out, forget it. You have to have a day job just to support yourself, pay the bills, eat, you know, and if you've got a family, you know, basically the term is you have a life.
Not everybody can be a John Grisham.
Nope.
And you mentioned that when John Steinbeck started out as a construction worker, mm-hmm. he was a war correspondent, World War II,
yep.
and he worked various jobs. And you yourself, you mentioned some of the jobs that you had.
Yeah. I've done everything from being an auto parts salesman to doing construction and so many. I worked for the newspaper where I grew up. Being a teacher, all, you know, various things.
Well, it occurs to me that jobs that require physical activity would be a very good complement to writing, because a writer spends a lot of time, I mean, these days they had a computer, and you have a chapter on get yourself a good chair.
Yeah.
Because, in fact, I know of somebody who started getting double vision, spent hours staring at a computer monitor, and I wonder, why am I getting double vision? And he sat with his head forward and crimping the blood vessels in the back of his neck, for Pete's sake.
I learned this the hard way, because I must have gone through seven or eight chairs. And going, why? I have a tendency to get migraine headaches anyway, but it's one of those things where I thought, okay, it's got to be the chair. So I thought, okay, it only makes sense. You can't just go into a store, local home, you know, office supply store, and go, I like that chair, let's get it, without sort of road testing it. You've got to road test this stuff. The same thing with a mouse, you know, any of that kind of stuff that you know you're going to be using for any length of time. Mice are not custom made to your hand, so you have to find the best fit
and
that you can.
And you're, people you're talking about, a computer mouse.
Computer mouse, right, yeah, not a squeaky mouse. But and same with the chairs. I have a really killer chair now, and my wife does too. She got one for herself, and it was it well worth the money. Well worth the money. So no more headaches. I find myself, my posture is better. My no more neck crimping, things like that.
Well, the same person that would, and you mentioned in your book, your wife will call you to dinner. Yeah. Well, let me finish this. And I'll be there in a minute. And let me finish this.
Right.
Before you know it, dinner is cold.
Yep.
Because you don't realize how much time you're sitting there. It
That's
can
correct.
Go by so fast. And I know this happened to the same writer who started getting double vision because the blood wasn't getting to his eyes. Realized, okay, it won't occur to me how long I've been sitting here, so I'm going to set a timer. And when the timer would go off, I don't remember what, an hour, he would get up and vacuum a room. Come back, sit down, the timer go off, go out, vacuum another room.
That's a good idea.
And he happened to be married, so that his wife was quite pleased that he came up with that idea.
That's really good. I like
win
that.
Win brownie points with your spouse.
Yeah, that's great. I have to remember that. I don't know. I'd be self-conscious with the timer, though, for me. But so I wouldn't pay attention to it anyway. I'd probably zone out. My wife did it to me last night, as a matter of fact. She said, honey, dinner's ready. And I'm going, okay, I'll be there in just a minute. You know, and I have no idea what happened after that.
My guest is T.E. Watson, and his newest book, Light and Stone, contains tips on writing and the realities of publishing. One tip that you have for people, and I think people who don't even plan to be writers could apply this to whatever situation they find themselves in. You say, take a deep breath.
Oh, all the time. All the time. I find myself, when I'm really getting into a work, I must remember to breathe because I'd stop. I didn't realize I was doing that, which accounted for headaches, accounted for stiff neck, accounted for sore back and whatnot. Because if you're not breathing, you're not getting oxygen into your body, which is an outstandingly super important part of this. You got to remember to breathe. And that's why, you know, if you can't remember to breathe, at least stand up for 10 minutes, walk around, go outside, breathe some air out there. And you're not breathing stare computer air. As I didn't put it in there. I'm putting in the next one. And the computer air can get really bad because you're going, oh, man, how come it's so stuffy in here? And you're starting to sweat and all this other kind of thing. And, but yeah, you got to breathe because if you're not breathing, you're not getting oxygen, especially to your brain. And that's the important part. If you can't get your brain to think properly and stay on focus and stay on that track, forget it. You're going to end up writing garbage. It won't work for you.
So, and something that simple, I'm sure a person does not realize that he's not breathing.
We forget. We honestly forget because we're into whatever we're doing so intensely that we go, oh, wait a minute. Oh yeah, I got to breathe here.
You had a quote by John, lyrics by John Lennon that I didn't recall which song they're from, but I liked it. You quote John Lennon, relax your mind and float downstream.
Yeah.
Now, how can a would-be writer apply that?
It's easy. When you're breathing, and you're breathing correctly, there is a method, and I show that in there. I believe I do.
Yeah, you give some tips on how to breathe.
Yeah. The idea is if you can do this methodology once, maybe two, three times a day, you're going to be able to stay laser focused, and you're going to be able to write so much better than you ever did before. You'll be amazed. Plus, your brain will be able to relax. You won't have the headache. You won't have the idea of going, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to be on muscles tightening and everything else, and I got to get this done. Well, no, it doesn't work that way. You got to breathe. It's so important.
Well, you have kind of a punchline also in your book. this is my phrasing now. How to make a small fortune in publishing? Start with a large fortune.
Yes, right.
A large fortune. Because I think people, you're trying to make people aware of the fact that it's going to cost money.
Yes, it does.
To publish a book. You need to hire professionals to look at your work.
Mm-hmm. If you want to do it right, do it right. Don't do it halfway. Just say, oh, I can do this. Well, no, you can't.
You know. Well, I've been hired to do some proofreading, and the person thought, okay, this is finished. It's ready to go to the publisher. And I would find so many things that had skipped their attention, that they had not seen.
Yeah, I'm sure. It happens all the time. Light and Stone had 12 editors. That was a year's process. So, yeah, it takes time. It takes money to have it done properly. Had a lady come to me and said, I have this book that my husband did, and I'd like to get it done. When can I have it in 2 weeks? I went, no. And I said, here, talk to this lady. So she went and talked to that lady, and now she's editing it, and it's like almost a year later. And I said, I told you. So, no, it takes time. It's a process to do correctly.
And I think people are eager to, oh, I finally finished this. Now I'm going to send it off to the publisher.
Yeah, can't
and
do it.
And off it goes, and what happens?
It falls down. Instantly falls down. Guarantee it every time. Got a friend up in Mendocino who came to me and said, I wrote a book. And I went, great. That's wonderful. How many rewrites did you do? Oh, I didn't have to. I went, okay, and I walked away. I didn't want anything to do with it because I knew what he was going to tell me. And I thought, this is nuts. You cannot do it in one go. It doesn't work.
It reminds me, in your book, a little boy in the first grade asked you, how many giraffes does it take to write a story?
Yes.
Giraffes. And giraffes. I thought, that's adorable.
That's the way he heard it. So I'm going,
because he doesn't know the word draft.
No, he doesn't.
But he knows the word giraffe. And so it takes a lot of giraffes to write a book.
It does. And he goes, how many? And I said, as many giraffes as want to come for the ride. So, and he goes, okay. And he walked away.
My guest is T.E. Watson. His latest book, contains tips on writing and the realities of publishing, and he calls it Light and Stone. And the light part is, you know, when somebody sits down to start writing, you say, well, don't worry about editing yourself at first. Just get it down. There goes a draft. It's not going to be the last draft.
Right.
But just get it down on paper.
Yeah, the light part is the easy part. These are the things that you should ask yourself before you even start. That's the light part, a more accurate definition.
And sometimes writers say, oh, I've got writer's block. And you say, you're already shaking your head.
Writer's block does not exist. I've never had writer's block. I know other writers that say, oh, I got writer's block. And I say, no, you don't have writer's block. You're just tired. You're lazy. And that, a lot of people get really upset with that. I go, no, you're being lazy. Just say, no, you can write about other stuff. You don't have to write about this all the time. You know, Light and Stone, it's like, no, I wrote that. Put it all together in about 2 years' time over a period of time. And that, after a while, I'm going, okay, wait a minute, I need to rewrite this. And never had the writer's block. Always had something to write about. Writer's block does not exist.
You have some other practical tips, like if you're sending it to a publisher, an agent, double space the manuscript, type it double space.
There is a format.
Make it easy for them to read. Yeah. And also send a self-addressed stamped envelope. Otherwise, it's going to go straight to the trash.
Yep.
And
however,
yeah,
there is a certain format that you've got to do. And if you don't do their dance, which you can research usually online, if you're not familiar with that dance, learn how to do that dance.
Well, thank you for these practical tips, Tom. I know would-be writers are going to be very eager to pick up a copy of your book.
Thank you. I hope so. Yeah.
The book is Light and Stone, Essays on Writing and the Realities of Publishing. The author is T.E. Watson. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshop on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.